This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a great pleasure for me to have in the studio two of the best left-wing journalists in America, Doug Henwood and Eliza Featherstone. Henwood is the editor and publisher of Left Business Observer, and Featherstone, a writer for Slate and The Nation, is the co-author of Students Against Sweatshops and also Selling Women Short, the landmark battle for workers' rights at Walmart. Doug Henwood and Eliza Featherstone, thanks for joining me on Progressive Radio.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Thanks, Matt.
Obama released his budget recently. What's your reaction to it?
Well, I haven't really gotten a chance to look at the numbers closely like I like to, but my impression is that, at least in the politics of it, he's completely rolled over to the dominant discourse about the need to cut. There is just really no talk about all the grandiose talk about investment and the long term and reordering our priorities has really taken a back seat now to the Republican-driven drive towards austerity. And Wall Street's love of austerity. It looks like he is playing to the bond market, just as Clinton did, and not making any effort to consolidate a new way of thinking, a new way of talking about politics. And it was remarkable that the economic crisis that we had, that there's been so little change in the way we think and talk about politics in the United States. By some accident, I happen to have Ronald Reagan's first inaugural address in my iTunes library.
Listening to it
a few months ago, and I was really struck by the way Reagan made a very clear break, and he said, "We can't go back to the ways of the past. There may be some short-term pain, but this will all pay off in the long term." And Obama could have made a very similar declaration of a break and a new beginning, but he never really did that. I mean, he's really spent a lot of public money to restore the status quo ante, writing big checks to Wall Street. There was a stimulus package that was good, but that was really about the last good thing he did. And then the politics of it have gotten very, very murky, and now it's been very easy for the right-wing Republicans to gain the upper discursive hand.
Eliza, why do you think Obama has been reluctant or unwilling to engage in kind of ideological combat?
Yeah, I mean, it's really striking. I mean, when you're listening to the State of the Union address, I mean, he said a lot of good things. We need to invest in renewable energy. We need to invest more in education. But to really do the things he's talking about, I mean, would require such a reordering of priorities. And really, I mean, the American ruling class needs a tiger mom. I mean, it really needs someone to say, look, you know, stop whining. You're going to have to pay more taxes. You know, you've been spoiled for long enough. You have to think about somebody else for a change. And he's just not that.
He's not a fighter, but, you know, the ruling class wins every time they play chicken. I mean, they get 100 cents on the dollar whenever they call anybody's bluff. So,
when the New York Fed under Geithner was negotiating the AIG deal, most private investors are not expecting 100 cents of the dollar. You go into a reorganization deal with any kind of private actors, you have 50 cents of the dollar, 60 cents of the dollar. But Geithner said, no, we have to pay 100. I mean, he didn't even act like the way a Wall Street shark would have acted. And, you know, he's the state. He should have said, you know, here's 50 cents of the dollar and say thank you on the way out.
But there's an incredible quote Geithner gave where he didn't say he was the state. He said it was his job as the Treasury Secretary to maintain the private system.
Well, he is. It's right. I mean, that, I guess he's really speaking truth there. And, you know, I think by expressing disappointment in Obama's not reordering the discourse, I'm actually probably giving him too much credit for having that in his heart. I mean, this guy is very conventional and very centrist and really doesn't like to fight, except maybe when he's fighting teachers' unions.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Doug Henwood and Eliza Featherstone today. Doug, I read something you wrote about a year ago where you said, for an instant, you thought Obama was a grown-up who could prod a maturing country in a more sensible direction.
It was only an instant.
Why were you wrong on that?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think he just didn't have the political inclination to do that. The social forces in the country were not organized to push him in that direction. A lot of people were really disarmed by his rhetoric and their infatuation with him.
It wasn't an infatuation thing.
Yeah,
it wasn't a movement.
It was delusional. I mean, it was a fan club.
Right, exactly.
It was not a movement at any means. But also, I think there's also a personal angle to it in that a lot of people made comparisons with Roosevelt. FDR came out of the elite and had the confidence to step on their toes. Obama was a guy who was raised by the meritocracy. I mean, he was adopted at every level from when he was a kid by elite institutions, his school in Hawaii, then a series of Ivy League institutions, foundations. He was groomed for success, and I think he is in awe of these institutions that made him made him president.
He believes in the meritocracy. He believes the system works.
It did well by him. And I was shocked to read Game Change, that book by Halpern and whoever, that almost from the instant that Obama got to the Senate, he was groomed to be president by the Democratic leadership. You know, this is not an outside insurgent candidacy. Harry Reid took him in and said, "You're not cut out for the Senate. You're not a backslapping, deal-making kind of guy. Why don't you run for president?" And you know, so this guy has really been anointed from an early age.
He was, and yet there was real euphoria when he won, and actually legitimate reason for the euphoria, because it appeared anyway to mark at least somewhat of a break from the almost neo-fascist direction of Bush Cheney, and also there was an obvious step forward in race relations, at least a symbolic step forward. So I think everyone was that evening. I mean, I remember seeing Naomi Klein in Madison, Wisconsin 3 days later, and even someone as wise as she was kind of exuberant. And yet she said, "We need a divorce right now." And of course she was right about that. But I remember seeing a cover of Newsweek where he was dressed in drag as FDR and with the monocle and the whole thing. And yet he hasn't wanted to be FDR. I mean, he's just never wanted to do that, Liza. I read something you wrote where you said, "We've got neither the political will nor the from the top," meaning Obama, "nor the organization at the bottom," meaning the working public, "to force workers' rights on the agenda." What would it take to force those rights on the agenda, Liza?
Well, I think I think it would take some either some combination or a lot of force from the bottom. You know, I mean, I think that I think that a lot of the a lot of educated and, you know, well-meaning people were pretty infatuated with Obama because they assumed that that meant that a lot of good things were now going to come from the top. And I think, you know, we've seen in American history that that actually almost never happens. You know, I mean, that we really can't depend on the leaders. And, you know, we can be annoyed at Obama for not delivering that, but it would be such a historical anomaly if he had either the desire or the ability to do that, to deliver that kind of change. So, you know, I think really what it really will take is a lot more of what I've been seeing in your town, which is people storming the Capitol and demanding an end to this neoliberal union busting and decimation of the public sector.
Well, not exactly storming, because people are so polite here.
Well, I know.
Yeah, but let's talk about it, though. It's been extraordinary to watch recently in Wisconsin, where we have a new Republican governor, Scott Walker, Hosney Walker, as the signs called him, and also a new Republican state senate and a new Republican state legislature. And what they've tried to ram through within the first couple months of coming to office is the biggest attack on public sector workers that we've seen in Wisconsin. It would eliminate all bargaining except on wages. It would require recertification of every public sector union every year. It would require employers not to deduct union dues. You could not. It would be illegal to deduct union dues. So it's totally defanging the unions, or taking any power away from the unions. And also it would strip people of their a lot of their pensions and require enormous pay cuts, so that if you're making $40,000, you'd be losing something like $5,500 a year, according to a University of Wisconsin secretary who I talked to at one of the protests. So the Republicans, the weird thing about these right-wing Republicans is they only talk to themselves. And they thought they were going to get away with it and that people were just going to roll over. But Wisconsin has a long union tradition here, fighting tradition. And the unions, and not just the union leadership, but working people rose up and wouldn't let it happen or have tried not to let it happen. So there's a huge fight back, and that fight back's going to continue. So that's exciting. I mean, there were one day 15,000 people, the next day 30,000 people jamming the Capitol building and the Capitol grounds, even with snow on the ground. And, you know, it may be that the Republicans win, but in the short term, I don't think they're going to win in the long term. And yet I've been waiting for 2 years, really, 3 years, to see more of this happening all across the country. The huge anomaly of American politics, and I think, Doug Henwin, you've written about it since 2008, was we have 15 million officially unemployed workers and millions more, and we have millions of people thrown out of their homes because of the mortgage scams, or because they were over their heads, and yet we didn't see people in the 15 million people in the streets.
You know, I think Walker's mistake may have been to be too aggressive, and I think you're going to see, you know, we're already seeing similar things in states around the country, and by not perhaps being somewhat less extreme, it may not provoke the same reaction. In New York, we've got a Democratic governor who's going after the public employee unions, too, and this fact, the fact that he's a Democrat may also disarm some of the opposition, and he's not going for the kind of maximalist agenda you outlined there, either. He's just, you know, it makes more sense from an elite point of view just to chip away at things. You know, the death by a thousand cuts rather than this giant machete approach. But also, you know, because Wisconsin also has a rich union tradition. So of course, New York does too. But we're not seeing the kind of mobilization nationally against this sort of thing. It's just, but you know, I think a lot of people on the left have made a historic mistake in thinking that economic crises are actually good for the left. That was true in the 30s because the unemployment rate hit 25% and people had nothing to lose. When the unemployment rate's 10%, people are scared and want to protect themselves, and they're, you know, like turtles who pull into the shell. So it's not necessarily the case that an economic crisis is good for progressive politics.
And the worse the better theory is immoral anyway, because people are suffering so bad.
It's horrible, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know people who cheer on crashes and think that this is going to be a good thing, some sort of deus ex machina that will make everything good happen. It's just not going to work that way.
Yeah, and that's sociopathic, obviously. I mean, you don't want to see people suffering. I mean, I think, though, you know, you haven't really seen massive protests of the unemployed, because when unemployment is, you know, not at 25%, but closer to 10%, people still feel very ashamed that they're unemployed, you know, even though it isn't personal. You see lots of highly skilled, very talented people still out of work, but people still feel like, you know, if I could just get it together, I would still have a job. And these attacks on public workers are a bit different because these people know that they have skills and that their work is very valued. And, you know, that even though there is a lot of ideological garbage being thrown at them, they do have a sense that they, you know, that their work is important.
Although it must be said, I think there are a lot of people in the private sector who think, well, I don't have any of those things. Why should these people have these things? Cut away.
Yeah.
So and that's the game the Republicans are playing on. I
mean, yes.
They've been totally pitting public sector workers versus private sector workers. But the logic of that is just a horrid race to the bottom.
Yeah. But the politics can work. Mark Ames has written a lot about how the American political psyche is just full of meanness and resentment. And I think that's probably overstating the case. But certainly there's something there to tap into.
I'm speaking with Doug Henwood and Liza Featherstone. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. How do you think this is going to pan out, this pitting of public sector workers versus private sector workers? Are the Republicans going to be able to continue to get mileage on this?
Well, unfortunately, I think I think, yes, unless we see a lot more of the kind of fight we've been seeing here in Wisconsin. I mean, I think that one thing that is, I mean, a lot of what we have been seeing in Wisconsin that is so wonderful is the way that the the demonstrators have really been able to seize the high ground. You know, the teachers are out there saying, look, we educate your kids, you know, and, you know, people are bringing their kids to the protests. And I mean, and elsewhere in, you know, New York and certainly a lot of the country, the right, and by right, I mean Republicans and Democrats, have been able to successfully to frame it as if there's a conflict between, for example, teachers' unions and the quality of education. You know, that, you know, they've been able to be like, we're the ones defending children by busting these teachers' unions, which is so, you know, which is sort of seems like such crazy doublespeak. Like, we want to pay the people who take care of your kids all day less money, and therefore we have your kids' interests in mind. But it's a doublespeak that they have been able to pull off very successfully, and you would be surprised how many sophisticated people in New York, for instance, seem to fall for it.
You know, certainly a lot of states, most states, have very severe budget crises, so there's something, you know, something has to be done. The LA Times had this neat thing on their website a few weeks ago where you could try to solve the budget crisis in California on your own.
Oh, that was a wonderful thing.
And they only limited the choices to things that were sort of already in the debate. But I managed to produce a surplus in the California budget by raising taxes on rich people, increasing the tax on the extraction of oil, releasing people from prison, and a couple other things like that, and without cutting social services or education. And it was remarkable that it can be done, but these things are just written out of the discourse. You can't raise taxes on rich people. You know, it's just not to be said.
Yeah, I did it too, yeah. And you didn't even have to let you could just let the nonviolent offenders out of prison, and you know, you still ended up with the, I mean, it was
nobody
very
wants to release serial murderers.
Exactly.
Prison, but you know, there are a lot of people in jail who should not be.
And was part of the equation the possibility that the federal government would give more money to the
states? That was not on the list.
No, yeah. Not even on the list. You
and
could
that
do it
was
even
a real problem
that.
With Obama's initial stimulus package that he bowed again to Republicans who didn't want to give more money to the states. And I think the Republicans knew that the states were going to be over a barrel and were going to be facing crises and budget deficits and would be exploiting them as they are.
Well, they also want to break the public employee unions for political reasons because they're important sources of support for Democratic candidates. So if they break that, then that...
And that's, you know, part of taking the dues paying away from the unions here in Wisconsin. That's clearly a way to defund the Democratic Party in Wisconsin.
Which does beg the question, why did Democrats want to bust the public employees unions?
Save money.
I know, but I mean, given that they are an important source of Democratic support.
I mean, it's an oddity, and maybe it was happening with Cuomo in New York. It was certainly happening here in Wisconsin during the gubernatorial race. Both the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate were attacking public sector workers during the campaign.
All over the country.
That's gratitude for you.
Yeah.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. And I've got, as guests today, Doug Henwood of Left Business Observer and Liza Featherstone, a writer for Slate and The Nation, and the author, of course, of Students Against Sweatshops and the great book on Walmart called Selling Women Short. Let's talk a little bit more about Obama's education policy. There was a huge hue and cry about George W. Bush's education policy, and then Obama came in, and how much is different?
Well, it's actually more aggressive and more effective than Bush's policy was. The race to the top has completely transformed the landscape in the country. There's more pressure than ever before for testing and all that. The whole agenda, and what they call accountability measurement and accountability, all these things that they've been pushing. And now, by dangling billions of dollars, which was money that came out of the stimulus bill, so it didn't actually have to come up for a congressional vote, in front of the states and making them adhere to this model and compete for the funds, they've actually managed to transform educational policy in all 50 states in ways that Bush couldn't do.
How so specifically? Do either of you have an example?
More testing, for example.
Yeah. I mean, we ran a story in The Progressive of a kindergarten teacher who said in Milwaukee that she has to put her kindergarten kids through something like 50 standardized tests in a year. Kindergartners.
Yeah. And what people say is the finest educational system in the world, Finland, has, I think the average Finnish student has only two or three standardized tests in his or her entire career. You know, and then you get that money in a week in an American school, it seems.
So why did Obama take this road?
Well, I mean, it's really pretty remarkable. If you look at I mean, you know, maybe this seems like a little bit of a personal line of criticism, but here we go. I mean, he sends his children to Sidwell Friends School, which is a lovely, very progressive private school in Washington, D.C., you know, I mean, where, I mean, they, you know, it would be, you know, very arts-based. I'm sure they play all day in kindergarten and never have to take a test. You know, I mean, and, you know, it's really just the, it's, you know, probably the sort of education that all children should have. And, you know, very rigorous. And, of course, they all get into good colleges. You know, I mean, so, I mean, you know, so it's kind of remarkable to me that the kinds of schools that he champions through Race to the top and are rewarded are these high stakes testing charter schools where you know, very little critical thinking is encouraged, very little individuality, very little of the qualities that people actually need to succeed in the society beyond just being a competent cog in the, you know, food service machine.
Well, that's the message. That is the way to succeed in the future of American society.
I mean, and there was...
That's competitiveness.
And there was, I mean, I wrote recently about, there was a disturbing report by the Office of Charter Schools in New York City, because Bloomberg's policy on education has been very similar to Obama's, you know, just to focus pretty much on test scores exclusively. And this report was the charter school office itself investigating these schools and deciding whether they should be able to extend to, you know, be able to teach more children, whether they should be able to continue operating. They were all approved to continue operating. Almost all of them were approved to expand into high school or into elementary school or whatever they weren't yet doing. And they were all praised as being, you know, academically strong. Although in most cases, the investigators said, we saw no evidence of critical thinking being taught. We saw no evidence that of, we saw no examples of students having a discussion. You know, I mean, you know, this is their
just
own
kind of robotic,
their own internal report.
You'd almost think that's what they want.
I mean, and that, yeah, in every case they concluded that it was still fine. You know, it was like, well, and it was almost a window into, we know what good education looks like. We just don't think disadvantaged, poor African-American children need to have it. And you would almost get the same impression from the dichotomy of Obama sending his kids to Sidwell Friends while, you know, the poor and average of the world get high-stakes testing.
I was actually reading the Sidwell Friends website the other day, and it sounds pretty sweet.
It does sound sweet. I looked at it as well.
But, you know, the charters, all the evidence on charters is, well, it's very mixed. Some studies show some improvements. Some studies show they're not as good. But you average them all out and you find they're really not all that different, just in terms of measurable outcomes, whatever that means. Yeah. But the teachers are not unionized. They come fresh out of school, last a few years, and then quit. So you have this very young workforce that has worked very hard, like as much as 60 hours a week, and paid poorly. So I think that is really what it's all about, is cutting costs and producing the similar results, or maybe even producing even more robotic graduates than now. But they don't want to encourage critical thinking because that might cause trouble.
Yeah, no, I mean, they want to breed a reasonably quiescent working class, and they want to break teachers' unions. I mean, and you do. I mean, I actually have been visiting a lot of schools because my son needs a kindergarten next year, and you know, you go into these charter schools, and everybody, all the teachers look like they're 12 years old, and you know, and they in fact are. They're much younger than the average teachers, and you know, it's remarkable. I think we are really the only country in the world that thinks that a way to reform an education system is to put in less experienced people. You know, like that's supposed to be, you know, and people will say, oh, it's so great, they're all so young. It's like, would you say that about any other field. Like, it's so great that the workers are not very experienced.
So great the surgeon's so young.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Liza Featherstone and Doug Henwood. This is Progressive Radio. We got about 4 minutes left. I'm wondering if either of you think there ought to be a challenge to Obama in 2012.
Oh, you know, that would be nice. But really, I think the problem is the organization of the broad society. I mean, if we have another candidate, who would it be? You know, I think this is the lesson of the Nader campaign, is that these kinds of celebrity campaigns, and there are many ways to admire Ralph Nader, but he never did anything to organize anything beyond the electoral moment. And that, I think, is really what we need to do. I mean, we need to organize, we need better organizations of all kinds. We need better unions. We need better community organizations. You know, we need better interest groups. Even look at, like, the reproductive rights movement in the country. It's all about lobbying and litigation and campaign contributions. There's no effort to organize anything like a popular movement. And, you know, the right has been very good at organizing popular movements. The Tea Party, you know, is a crackpot and all kinds of things you can say about it. And it isn't even really an authentic grassroots popular movement by according to a lot of people who've looked at them up close, but they've managed to mobilize large numbers of people for an actual political agenda.
It may have become an actual grassroots movement. It certainly didn't start that way.
But yeah, but it needs to be. That's what we need. I mean, I think the presidential level of politics, you know, Workers' Vanguard refers to the president as the chief executive of the world bourgeoisie, which is, of course, you know, nice old Trotsky's boilerplate, but there's something to it. And we're not going to be able to compete at this point on that level of politics. It needs to be much more organized from below than we're experiencing now.
Yeah, I mean, I really agree. I mean, I think as mad as we get at Obama, I'm not really sure that our political system could actually produce a much better candidate or president as it currently is. I think, you know, he may be the best we can do without really getting in the street and changing our political culture.
I mean, it's interesting because after one of the biggest disappointments with Obama, and I can't remember which it was, it wasn't health care, but it was after health care. I guess it was the tax cuts for the billionaires. There was all this boomlet, you know, we got to run someone against Obama. And I wrote something on the Progressive's website saying, A, who's it going to be? But also, let's look at an old concept in economics. What are the opportunity costs? I mean, the labor unions have spent $100 million at the last election to try to get Democrats elected. Now, how many organizers could you hire for $100 million?
And that's
right. You know, that would go...
Well, if they put that kind of money and people into a single-payer health bill, we'd be having a very different set of politics now.
And there's the opportunity cost, but there's also... look at the opportunities. Like if you don't put the resources into some futile challenge of some Democrat that's probably not going to be much better, you know, what else could you do with those resources?
Exactly.
Quite a lot.
And so I just think there's a lot of frustration on the progressive side right now with Obama. And part of it was people had that infatuation that you talked about with Doug earlier. But people need to get over it and start doing the work that we need to do day in and day out. And to see what was happening in Wisconsin over the last a little while was exciting for those of us who were here, and most of you listening weren't here. And I hope that wherever you are that you can, you know, support public sector workers, union workers, in this fight to take this country back, not only from the Republicans, but from the ideology of the Republicans that Obama has bought.
And take the word of these visitors to Wisconsin. It's inspiring. Everyone should try it.
Absolutely. Very
good. Doug Henwood and Liza Featherstone, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.